Ms. Pettit, and Mr. Rosenberg. Welcome to the Fifth Circuit Zoom session.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'm Judge Dennis, together with Judge King and Judge Cole. We'll be your panel this afternoon in Mark Beasy versus Greg Abbott.
Recording in progress.
We'll hear first from Ms. Pettit.
Thank you, Judge Dennis, and may it please the court. As used in fee shifting statutes, the phrase prevailing party is a legal term of art. In a case like this that proceeded to final judgment, the court determines whether the plaintiffs meet the definition of that term by looking to the judgment itself, not whether, colloquially speaking, plaintiffs got what they wanted when they started the lawsuit. In this instance, because the plaintiff's claims were dismissed on the merits, they are not prevailing parties and are therefore not entitled to attorney's fees. Now, I know that's a bit counterintuitive given the plaintiff's initial success in showing that SB 14, as it was passed in 2011, violated the disparate impact analysis under Section 2. But in fact, it is a straightforward application of the Supreme Court's decision in 2001 in Buchanan, which held that voluntary ameliorative action by the state does not convey prevailing party status, even if it accomplished the result as if it had been litigated on the merits. And they reached that conclusion by rejecting many of the same policy arguments that plaintiffs raise here, as can be seen in Justice Ginsburg's dissent. Instead, they followed the plain language of the phrase prevailing party as it had been used in dozens of fee shifting statutes over a period of decades, which every time attached that form of relief as incident to a legal judgment or consent decree. Here, because plaintiffs got a take nothing judgment, they take nothing in terms of attorney's fees. Now, the plaintiffs try to get around that by pointing to three
different— Just to be clear, the 2016 interim plan was not voluntary, was it?
The 2016 interim plan was an agreed plan. It was entered by the court, but as the a number of courts—
It was entered by the court because you lost in the Fifth Circuit at the en banc phase.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the Fifth Circuit—
You would have wanted SB 14 to take effect, and the courts through the whole process said no, specifically with respect to the 2016 election cycle. Why isn't that sufficient under the Buchanan three-part test?
Because, Your Honor, this court vacated the judicial remedies that were attached, and as the Supreme Court recognized in 1987 in Hewitt against Helms, a statement of law by an intermediate court of appeals is not a form of judicial relief that attaches with the necessary judicial imprimatur, and I'm looking at page 760 of that opinion, as well as page 762. Since this court vacated the actual remedy that was approached, the 2016 judgment was by itself not a declaratory judgment and insufficient to convey prevailing party status.
But you're saying that the interim order doesn't satisfy the three-part Buchanan test. What part does it not satisfy? Because it strikes me that it's judicially sanctioned, it materially changes the legal relationship, and it benefits the plaintiffs. It changed the election rules in exactly the way that the plaintiffs wanted, or maybe not exactly, but it changed the voting rules contrary to what the state had wanted for 2016.
Yes, Your Honor, but in 2007, the Supreme Court refined that test in Soule against Weiner and said that, and I'm looking at page 77 of that opinion, where an interim relief such as this was, and I'm quoting here, reversed, dissolved, or otherwise undone before the final judgment.
Okay, so to be clear then, your argument is not that the three-part test of Buchanan isn't satisfied. It's that what Buchanan may give the plaintiffs some other case takes away. Is that sort of your theory?
Yes, Your Honor, in the sense that the interim relief, that they cannot rely on the interim relief because it was vacated prior to the final judgment, which in Buchanan was also a similar situation where in that case, the plaintiffs in that case also had a form of interim relief that was vacated before the final judgment. And because West Virginia had changed their fire code and because it had been vacated, it was no longer effective in Buchanan as well. But more on point is the Soule decision in 2007, as well as this court's decision in Dearmore in 2008. And that case refined what the second element of Buchanan, which is a material change in the relationship between the parties in the instance where an interim relief is no longer effective. And there the court looks to whether there was a preliminary injunction, whether it was on the merits, and whether it was mooted out by the defendants prior to final judgment. And here, because the case was the interim relief was agreed and simply reflected in an interim order as opposed to directly ordered, there's a bit of a question under Doe against Nixon in the Eighth Circuit whether that counts as a preliminary injunction. But we're not actually challenging that here. We're challenging that third element, which, as this court recognized in Hornbeck Offshore, is a crucial element to the Dearmore test, namely whether the relief caused the defendants to moot out the case. And that has been extensively litigated in this case, most recently in 2018, where the plaintiffs challenged that the case had been mooted because they didn't get the full relief that they wanted. Specifically, they were trying to establish that Texas was bailed in under Section 3. And this court held that that was inappropriate and sent it back down for entry of a judgment in the defendant's favor. At the time that judgment was entered, there had been no interim relief in effect for nearly a year. And under Soule against Weiner, that means that the interim relief does not, standing alone, serve as something that it conveys prevailing party status. So we've talked about two different forms of the relief or the interim actions that the plaintiffs point to. And so I want to make sure I cover the third. And that third is the 2018 decision itself, which the plaintiffs maintain creates the necessary judicial imprimatur because it effectively endorsed the SB 5 as a remedy for this case. That is also incorrect for a number of the reasons we've discussed, in particular back to that decision in Hewitt v. Helms, that a statement by this court standing alone is not a declaratory judgment or a consent decree or any other form of judicial relief, and therefore cannot convey prevailing party status. Now, plaintiffs insist that that is different because this is a voting case. But the only extent to which a voting case is different is in the world of preclearance, and where there is, in fact, a requirement for a piece of legislation to go into effect that a judge approve it. But that world is different after Shelby County in 2013. That's been stripped out as unconstitutional. So we're back to the general rule that a legislature is presumed to act in good faith, and it can only be overcome by the plaintiffs. In that instance, where preclearance is not in effect, this court has applied the same test even in voting cases. And I'm looking Pettaway itself, which announced this court's view of Buchanan was a voting case, as was LULAC against Texas Democratic Party in 2011 and Davis against Abbott, I believe, in 2015. So whether this is a voting case or not, there has to be, at the end of this litigation, either a judgment in the plaintiff's favor, which does not exist, or a form of interim relief that has not been, once again, reversed, dissolved, or otherwise undone. That also doesn't not exist because
Can you really undo interim relief, though, in this situation? Because the interim relief affected the 2016 election, right? It governed how the 2016 election was administered. And, you know, it may have been undone judicially after the election, but frankly, what's there left to undo? The election had taken place. For all intents and purposes, there was permanent relief as to the 2016 election, wasn't it?
Your Honor, that we can't undo the 2016 election, but I would point you to the facts of Soule as well, which involved a request for permission to perform a performance art, shall we say, involving a nude peace sign on a beach. That peace sign went into effect. The plaintiff was allowed to do what they wanted, and then it was undone afterwards. They couldn't unring the bell in that instance either, and the Supreme Court nonetheless said, in a unanimous opinion by Justice Ginsburg, the very dissenter in Buchanan, said that it was not sufficient to convey prevailing party status. And the same applies here. Because the relief had been dissolved before final judgment, we are back in the Buchanan world of, does that final judgment, is it in favor of the plaintiffs or the defendants? Here, that final judgment is in favor of the defendants, and so the plaintiffs are not prevailing parties, and the district court erred by ordering attorney's fees.
To your point, eventually, Seoul has sort of that same temporal aspect to it. They got relief to engage in their expression at that moment. It was taken away later, but the expression had already taken place.
Yes, Your Honor. And there have been a number of similar cases, both in the Supreme Court and in the courts of appeals, where there is a temporary change in the legal relationship, and that has some effect while it's in effect. But if it's dissolved before final judgment under Buchan, it's not considered to, in the second element, materially affect the legal relationship. So if there are no further questions, we respectfully request that you reverse.
Mr. Rosenberg?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Ezra Rosenberg on behalf of the Texas State Conference of NAACP branches and the Mexican American Legislative Caucus, and advocating on behalf of all the private plaintiffs in this case. To begin with, Your Honor, we are, under any reading of the law, prevailing parties in this case. We obtained a merits determination of Section 2 results violation after a 9-day trial that was affirmed on appeal en banc by this court. And that merits determination was not disturbed on appeal. And that's crucial because counsel for defendants has been relying on the Seoul versus Weiner case, which is an extraordinarily different case. There, the reason that it wasn't a matter of the preliminary injunction simply being dissolved. What happened there is that the preliminary injunction was issued on virtually day one of the case. And then after a year of discovery and then a trial, the plaintiffs lost on the merits of the trial. We never lost on the merits of the Section 2 results violation. In fact, the Section 2 results determination has been left completely undisturbed, not only through the end of the case, but was the basis for this court's 2018 decision that found that SB 5 was an adequate remedy for the Section 2 violation. Without that,
is your take on Seoul is it's sort of like an almost like an administrative stay? It wasn't really it was relief in a sense, but it was very non-substantive as contrasted to this case.
Absolutely, Judge Ho. As a matter of fact, there are two bases. One, that it was on day one, it was an abbreviated hearing and virtually
almost like a PRO or administrative stay.
Exactly. And that's the problem with the PI cases, the preliminary injunction cases, frankly. They're very different than our case. Our case was based on an interim remedial order that was issued at the directive of this court en banc based upon a conclusive merits determination, not probability of success on the merits, not an abbreviated hearing in support of whether or not the status quo should be preserved or not. Very, very different from preliminary injunction. Matter of fact, much, much stronger than any preliminary injunction situation. And again, the Seoul people lost on the merits. We did not lose on the merits. And contrary to what counsel said, there is absolutely nothing in the final judgment of this case or anything along the way to the final judgment of this case that indicates we lost on the merits. In fact, to the contrary, the 2018 decision of this court was that we had won on the merits, and that's why this court had to exercise its jurisdiction, deny defendants' argument, reject defendants' argument that the case was moot, because it had to exercise its jurisdiction to see whether the remedy that was proposed via SB 5 was adequate. Completely different circumstance. We meet the standard in Pettaway, this Fifth Circuit standard, that we left the courthouse, the Southern District Courthouse, having obtained judicial relief in two significant ways that materially altered the legal relationships between plaintiffs and defendants in a way that immediately benefited the plaintiffs. And that's all we have to prove. And the two ways, of course, are first and foremost, the interim remedial order, which was issued at the directive of this court en banc because defendants lost their appeal on the issue of whether or not there was a Section 2 results violation. This was not, as counsel just said, a voluntary act by the state. The state negotiated the terms of the interim remedial order with the gun pointed to their head of a decision on liability en banc on Section 2 results. And to characterize that as voluntary, really, it's an illusion or a delusion. It simply was not a voluntary act.
You can lose on liability and then negotiate over the remedy.
Of course, Your Honor. And that happens very, very often. And that was a complete loss. And it was a complete loss that remained up to and through the final disposition of this case. And the interim remedial order in and of itself, standing alone, is enough to provide prevailing party status. And I note just in passing, even though the defendants have not challenged the reasonableness of the fee award, but virtually the entire fee award that we sought and that was granted was for time spent up to and through the issuance of the interim remedial order and the enforcement proceedings to ensure compliance with it. So the discussion should really end there, Your Honor. But of course, we have more. And the more that we have is in the context of the judicial imprimatur given by this court in its 2018 decision that approved SB 5 as the permanent remedy in this case for any violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, be it discriminatory results or discriminatory intent, which had been found by the district court. And it also had been left undisturbed because the panel decided not to review that issue because they felt that the remedy was sufficient under either prong. And what is essential to the courts reaching whether or not SB 5 was an adequate remedy was the fact that there had to have been a violation for which there was a remedy, because this court does not issue opinions in the abstract. The court would not have exercised its jurisdiction to see whether or not SB 5 was an adequate remedy without there being an underpinning of a merits determination that there had been a violation. So that also, although we don't really need it because the interim remedial order gives us enough, is a separate basis, and taken together, I think is again, the discussion should end there. But then defendants start to really create standards that don't exist and exceptions that don't exist to these standards. There is no standard that there has to be a final enforceable judgment that tells defendants what to do. Buchanan does not say that. Matter of fact, there was no order in Buchanan requiring the defendants to do anything. What they did was completely voluntary. No court has construed Buchanan as doing that. And in fact, Dearmore says quite specifically that Buchanan does not require a final judgment. And in fact, a preliminary injunction can be the judicial relief for purposes of attorney's fees. There does not have to be a final judgment. There's just no way around it. That is precisely what Dearmore says. And here, of course, we have more than a preliminary injunction. We have a decision that was on the merits, not simply probability of success on the merits. Furthermore, defendants then argue that, well, you have to have mootness. That is the reason why plaintiffs don't get a final judgment in their favor. But that is only true in the context, if at all, of a preliminary injunction case. And this is not a preliminary injunction case. And the reason there may be those kinds of protections are, as Your Honor, Judge Ho indicated, preliminary injunctions are somewhat different. They might be done kind of almost like administrative hearings. They might be done in a very abbreviated form or simply to preserve the status quo. So the court had to assure itself that there was no indication that the merits had been undermined by the final judgment. But in fact, we have here the functional equivalent of mootness. As the court stated in the 2018 opinion, in voting rights cases under Section 2, I should say that first, had this not been a voting rights case, the court indicated that the enactment of SB 5 may in fact have mooted out the case. But because it was a voting rights case, this court had the obligation to exercise its jurisdiction to see whether or not SB 5 was an appropriate remedy. And to hold otherwise would really undercut the whole purpose of this circuit's policy in deferring to the legislature when there is a finding of an SB 5 violation. ultimately, what defendants are posturing is a situation that a plaintiff is better off, it has a better claim to be a prevailing party if it has gotten only a preliminary injunction rather than a decision on the merits, and its case has been mooted rather than the court adjudicating whether or not it has gotten an inadequate remedy. And that makes absolutely no sense. And then finally, Your Honor, counsel raised the catalyst theory and talked in terms of the fact that, well, first of all, they can't possibly explain how the catalyst theory applies to the interim remedial order, or for that matter, to SB 5, because they've repeatedly told this court and the district court that SB 5 was enacted in direct response and in order to cure the deficiencies found by this court en banc as his Section 2 violation. So instead, what they do is they look at our brief and they say, oh, wow, you quoted Justice Ginsburg several times from her dissent in Buchanan. And you must, because you're quoting from the dissent, you must be embracing the dissent rather than the majority opinion, even though the quotes they use have nothing to do with the issue of whether or not there is a catalyst. And I'll highlight just one in closing, because they say that we quoted Justice Ginsburg as saying that successful civil rights attorneys act as private attorney generals. And Justice Ginsburg did say that, but so did Justice O'Connor, writing for the unanimous court in the seminal case of Texas State Teachers, where after noting that petitioners there had partial success in the case, but that had altered defendants' policies, she said, petitioners have thus served the private attorney general role which Congress meant to promote in enacting Section 1988. They prevailed on a significant issue in the litigation and have obtained some of the relief they sought, and thus are prevailing parties within the meaning of Section 1988. Private plaintiffs here have achieved no less a victory than those petitioners. And whether prevailing party status is based upon the interim remedial order or SB 5 or both, the outcome is the same. And for all of these reasons, we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's award of attorney's fees and costs. But I'm happy to answer any further questions, Your Honor.
There's no questions. So you have 5 minutes on the button.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of quick points. First, to respond to the discussion that opposing counsel had with Judge Ho about whether this was an administrative stay versus a decision on the merits. We've never disputed that it was a decision on the merits, but that is only one element of the Dearmore test. And the third element is whether or not that the interim relief caused the defendant to moot the case. And counsel says that it was that is not a necessary element, but Hornbeck Offshore against Salazar in 2013 held precisely the opposite, and this court is bound by that decision. The second is that the merits decision...
Well, does it make any sense, though, to say that only if the preliminary injunction is mooted that you'd have status? I mean, I may not say this very articulately, I apologize. That element makes sense when you don't get relief in any sort of permanent lasting way, and all you have to rely on is a preliminary injunction. So that essentially, then you have to make sure that the reason you ultimately lost is only because it was mooted, but you actually sort of would have won due to the preliminary injunction. Here you've got this interim order that, as we've discussed, has a sort of a permanent vibe to it, doesn't it? I mean, the 2016 election was dramatically altered due to the litigation. It certainly wasn't, you all would not have done what happened in the 2016 election without the litigation. And it was ordered, and it was ordered by the court, so it wasn't catalyst.
We would have enforced SB 14, but for the interim relief order. Whether that was a significant change in 2016 or not is not something that I can speak to, but that was exactly the same issue in Seoul. And Seoul said that if it's reverse dissolved or otherwise undone, not necessarily reversed on the merits. And I would also point out that we were talking about some incentives earlier, and I think the best way to see why this is, the mootness element is important, is also to look what happens with this particular, in the final relief. We were never able to seek Supreme Court review of that decision about our liability under Section 2, first because this court had vacated any remedial order. And then at the end, at final judgment, the judgment was in our favor. And so that's why the mootness element is important, is because there's no real way to make sure that it would finally have prevailed, but the defendants in that instance had prevented their own ability to appeal.
But just to be clear, when you say the later rulings were in your favor, this was obviously a multifaceted, multi-stage case. Both sides won different things at different points. At the end of the day, though, plaintiffs did shift the law. That as a result caused, you know, both a court order as well as subsequent legislation to be different from the original vision of the legislature, right? I mean, that's hard to dispute.
That is not disputed. However, okay. That was precisely the situation in Buchanan. And we agree with the opposing counsel when he said that
except that here it was court ordered.
So there was a court order saying that as SB 14 was originally passed, it violated Section 2, but there was no court order at the time that SB 5 was passed. And looking to the language in Buchanan, which we agree was completely voluntary, as opposing counsel suggested, but the plaintiff in Buchanan was held not to be a prevailing party because, and I'm quoting from, I believe, page 606, never have we awarded attorney's fees for a non-judicial alteration of actual circumstances. That is what happened here. And so as a result, under Buchanan, we are the prevailing party. Now we have the plaintiff closed with some discussion about how it doesn't make any sense for plaintiffs to be better off to have mooted the case to have been mooted. That takes a very sort of narrow view of better versus worse off, because they're better off in the sense that they have attorney's fees. But in looking to this particular instance, the reason why the plaintiffs resisted the notion that it was moot was because what they wanted was to bail Texas in. And I can point you on that one to page 39-136 of the record, where they make that specific request. If it had been mooted, they would have lost that request. They would have also lost the ability to cite this court's earlier decision under Munsingware. That was important enough for plaintiffs to gamble with their attorney's fees, and it turned out to be an unfavorable gamble because this court held that additional relief beyond the voluntary relief from SB 5 was inappropriate on the merits.
So I accept that understanding of the plaintiff's strategy. What's not clear to me is why that causes the attorney's fees to be gambled away.
Because under Sol, they found that there is the requirement that interim fee still be in place. And I'm also pointing towards some additional language from Buchanan, where the court wanted to avoid two things. One, to avoid a situation that discourages voluntary ameliorative action, and two, where the court turns the attorney's fees litigation into another major litigation about the subjective intent of the legislature. And to adopt the plaintiff's theory in this case would do precisely that. And for those reasons and the ones we discussed in our brief, this court should reverse.
Does that conclude your remarks, Ms. Pettit? Could I understand that? Well, if that is true, then this case is
recording submitted. Stopped.
This case is submitted, and we will proceed to the next case for the day.